development and hedge funds. He's got so many enemies, it's easier to figure out who doesn't hate him. Mayor Morning was present both nights. Ming of Glass, the vampire VIP, is on both guest lists. Ming justifies our presence. I see Matilda Johnson, Irina Hastings, and Samuel L. Clayton. Johnson and Hastings are big in the art scene, and Clayton is a local preacher and political up-and-comer. All three are on tonight's guest list, but were not on last night's. She paused and added, I see here that Clayton is not attending because of his sister's death at the Holloway's party. That would be Margaret Clayton, deceased. There may be more last-minute inclusions or cancellations, names that didn't make it onto tonight's guest list as compiled by the Secret Service and just sent to us. I pulled onto West Jackson, wondering if the original target was Abrams Tolliver, or one of the others, or more than one of the others. This was getting sticky. I rolled down the truck window and held out ID to the uniformed officer at the barricade. I followed his pointing finger to parking in the staging area. I'm on site in official parking, I said. Oakham, what's your 20? His 20 was his location. Oakham said, I see your POC POV. Park at the back of the lot where it adjoins the train tracks. Approaching you now. POC POV was piece of crap, personally owned vehicle. Oakham was making fun of my truck. I pulled into a parking spot between a van for EMTs and the special operations team, SWAT, patted the dash and cut off the engine. Oakham tapped on the window. I opened the door and slid to the ground. Shots sounded, two close together, followed by a third. Before the first two echoed, I was on the pavement underneath Oakham. Fear blasted through me, fear of being held down, fear of being controlled, memories of fighting for my life. I could take his life. Bloodlust slammed through me. On instinct, I elbowed him in the gut, rolled and hit his jaw with the heel of my other hand. A fast two-strike reaction, spook school training, fighting my need. Get off me, I yelled, kneeing him hard. Oakham oofed, breath leaving his body fast. I could have his life for the land. I hit him again. He rolled over out of my reach. Do not. I caught a breath, forced down the craving, the want, the blazing desire to kill, to take his blood and his life and his soul for the earth, to save myself. I found my feet and backed away, moving in a crouch into the shadows of early evening, hiding. Heard sirens taking off and tires squealing as if chasing a car. I shivered hard and took another breath. Do not ever, ever attack me again. Holy shit, he groaned, still on the ground half under my truck, curled in a fetal position. Oh, why'd you do that? I ignored him and tried to replay the shots and the echoes. I estimated them coming from a distance. More cop cars chased away. No more shots were fired. The unit's AR is behind the seat, I said, if you want it. Oakham shook his head no and made a little gagging sound. I locked the truck cab. Are you Special Agent Ingram? I flinched, whirled, pulled my service weapon, all at once. A female uniformed cop stood near me, crouched low between vehicles, as if to avoid shots fired. I swallowed a pillow-sized fear clogging my throat. I was breathing fast, my pulse beating in my temples in the back of my neck. I pushed down the bloodlust and managed to speak almost normally. I'm Ingram. Ming of Glass just drove up. She requests that you speak with her. If the vamps were here, it was now officially night. I bent and picked up my comms gear and my bullet-resistant vest and reseated my 10mm. Oakham was watching me as he rose from the ground, not quite all cat grace. His nose was bleeding where I'd hit him. The blood need reared up in me, almost as if it was a separate consciousness, a demon of deadly desire. I squeezed it down, forced my shoulders to relax. Surprisingly, the lust inside me complied, if only enough not to kill. Oakham wiped his nose on his jacket sleeve. If he reported the blow, I'd be in trouble. But he was grinning, a satisfied, intense smile that suggested something I couldn't interpret. His blonde hair hung over his eyes and his jaw was fuzzy with a 2-day beard he hadn't had last time I saw him only hours ago. The beard was a result of shifting to his cat and back to human. His cat was still close to the surface, but not so close that his eyes glowed. Yet. A thought squirmed in the back of my mind like a worm on a hook. That female cats often fought a male as part of mating rituals, which was not an idea I wanted to contemplate. I shoved it aside.
Where did the last shots come from?
Oakham asked the uniform as I geared up. Our eyes met and slid away. Met and slid away. Nervous, I reseated my Glock GDP-20 in the hard plastic holster with a faint click. Shooter in a car, drive-by, handgun, no casualties. They already got him. To me, she said, if you'll follow me and keep your head down. I was still fastening my vest as we drove through the lot, our feet silent on the pavement. I caught snatches of conversation between cops as we jogged.
25 rounds located so far, most in the restaurant's wall. Way more casings in the street than 25. No shit, way more. Witnesses are in the empty building next door. 2 bottles of perfectly good vodka hit and shattered. I hear the vodka set off a kitchen fire.
Singed the hair off a cook but didn't touch her scalp.
1091s are to stay in place until CSI and the MEs are finished.
Medical examiners are here?
I know, right? Weird.
1091s were dead bodies in Knoxville PD radio codes. The stink of gunfire and burned hair and scorched building fouled the air. I looked around for fire trucks and decided the trucks must have pulled up to the restaurant from the back, from the street on the other side. EMS units were lined up in the roadway, uniformed officers standing guard at the door to the restaurant, visible in the glaring headlights. Heavily armed SWAT officers were inside and out. Shadows flickered on the walls and the asphalt, oversized, bulked, armed. Over here. The uniformed cop jerked on my sleeve, pulling me against a marked vehicle. She pointed to a black limo across the street. In that one. It wasn't a long limo, but a short one. The vehicle looked heavy as if armored. Don't expect me to get any closer to the fangheads, she said. I like the blood in my veins where it belongs. Maintain cover position until we clear the street and the buildings. Thanks. I said, and I feel the same way about vampires, but you don't say no to Ming of Glass. Crouching, I stepped off the curb into the street and raced over. The chauffeur got out, hunkered down like I was, and opened the back door. I did not want to get in that limo, sit on that leather, touch anything with bare skin. The thought of dead possum and maggots wiggling on my bare feet nearly made me gag. As I ducked inside and sat, hands in my lap, my eyes adjusting as the door closed on me with a solid thunk. Special Agent Maggot, a familiar voice said.
Fanghead Yummy, I said, which was totally impolite, not that I cared as much as I might once have, except that the inside light came on and Ming was sitting beside the blonde vampire.
Ming of Glass, I said. Not apologizing, though the words I'm sorry wriggled in the back of my throat like a squirrel in a trap trying to get out. Mama might fear vampires, but she would be polite to Satan himself. I'd be polite, though I had a momentary vision of Mama meeting the devil in the middle of an ice storm, the angel of the morning hovering on bat wings at the end of Mama's shotgun.
You find us amusing?
Ming asked. I blurted a half-strangled laugh. No, ma'am. I just imagined my mama meeting, you.
Your mother fears Mithrins.
My laughter died. My mama survived her worst nightmare. Now she don't fear nothing. You called me over here? It wasn't exactly true, but it sounded good.
Do you feel maggots in my limousine?
I thought about lying, since I'd already insulted the chief bloodsucker in Knoxville. Not through my clothes. I thought you were inside Pierce's dreams when the shooting took place.
I was just arriving. I was delayed. If one of my kind was behind this shooting, is there any way you or your fellow non-human police officers could tell?
The cats aren't trackers. They're side hunters. We don't have our own canine paranormal dog. We don't have a werewolf on the team. And that would be the best nose-wear critter.
If I flew a werewolf in, could he track the shooter?
I doubt it. Too many scent patterns. I paused.
You have thought of something,
Ming said. Maybe. I frowned. It would be against regulations, but Psy-Led didn't always go by regs, and Jane Yellowrock had a tame werewolf.
Tell me what you are thinking,
Ming said, her voice full of velvet persuasion, a vampire mesmerism. I looked her in the eye. Really? You ain't gonna try that on me? 'Cause it don't work.
So I see.
Ming sat back against the leather, making it sigh like flesh still alive. She motioned to Yummy.
Go with her. Provide assistance as needed. Psy-Led will bring you back before dawn.
Ming looked at me, her eyes intense, giving a final little push with her voice and her mind.
You will bring her back before dawn.
I'll be glad to give Yummy a ride, but if traffic stalls us on the highway and she burns up, you and her paying to have my truck fumigated. I hear it's mighty hard to get out the burned vamp stink. Yummy made a strangled sound that might have been laughter. Ming's eyes went wide, and then she burst out laughing. She was still chuckling when Yummy followed me out of the limo into the exhaust-laden air and the two bright lights.
Girl, you are either stupid, or you got big brass ones,
Yummy said. I decided that no reply was the wisest reaction this time, not that I'd been wise for the last few minutes. Oakham appeared at my side, ushering us into the shadows cast by streetlights against the ornate brick wall of the building. He was walking fine now, and he took in Yummy as part of his constant scan of the street and buildings and law enforcement rushing around. Around us, Old City's Christmas decorations glowed, a festive red and white this year. To me, he said,
"Uniforms and feds found the greatest concentration of casings. They think the shooter stood in the green space there."
He jerked his chin to a couple of winter leafless dogwoods and evergreen plantings at the edge of a roofed overhang.
"There's some land. Rick wants you to get a read."
The patch of earth was maybe 10 feet by 20. That little bit of land. Ewan's... You're kidding.
Nope. I got your blanket out of your truck.
He held out my faded pink blanket and I took it, uncertain for two reasons. I had locked my truck, and the blanket suggested that Oakham either had a key or owned and knew how to use a Slim Jim. And I didn't like reading city land. It was usually dead land. Yummy leaned into Oakham and breathed deeply. I realized she was taking his scent.
Where, leopard? I am still eager to taste you.
Oakham turned his eyes from me to her and said,
"No. Again. No."
Yummy laughed and her voice took on that persuasive tone, low and liquid.
"You might change your mind. Such liaisons have always been things of pleasure. Enjoy."
I wondered if that meant that Yummy and Oakham had ever...
"Come on."
Oakham turned his back on her in a catty insult, speaking to me.
"I got a camera for you to work with."
Yummy's eyes lit up in what must have been relish at the insult, as if she found Oakham even more interesting and delightful prey now than before.
"Now, camera," Oakham said.
The camera was a ruse to keep the humans among us from having a fear reaction at a paranormal person. I was listed in Unit 18 as an undifferentiated paranormal,
meaning that I wasn't among the short list of paranormals with known powers, gifts, and disadvantages, like vampires catching fire and sunlight. Yummy knew I wasn't human because she had seen me communing with the land once, and because she knew Jane Yellowrock. Reading the land in such a public place might tell everyone everywhere that I wasn't human, and, well, I hadn't told my mama or daddy yet, so holding a camera was a ruse. Keeping to the semi-protection of the brick wall, I followed Oakham down the street to the winter bear trees. And the 10-by-20 plot of land was revealed to be the brick-paved outdoor eating area of a restaurant, one with cement planters for the trees and greenery. There were rounds everywhere, each marked with a numbered yellow evidence marker. Tables and chairs were overturned. Drinks were pooled and reeking of alcohol. There had been people eating out here when the shooting started, outside in the cold, which was just stupid to my way of thinking. But there was nothing for me to read, no land in sight. I looked at Oakham and crossed my arms over my chest. Yummy was watching the byplay with the same kind of amusement that a human might display when watching monkeys in a zoo. Oakham looked around, sighed.
Right. Okay. I see.
He handed me a camera.
Try anyway.
I threw the blanket back at him and sat on the cement edge of a planter, placed the camera on the ground prominently in front of me as if I had a purpose. I dug my fingers through 6 inches of mulch and then stuck them into the soil. It was good quality potting soil mixed with topsoil. There was a nice concentration of nutrients. One spot where some stupid human had dumped in a cup of coffee. I boosted the tree, just in case the winter was long and cold, and withdrew my hand. Nothing. But why do they think the shooter stood here? The rounds probably popped off the roof. I looked up. So did Oakham and Yummy, who pursed her mouth. She laced her fingers together, bent her knees, and said, "Come on, Cat. I'll boost you up and you can pull me up. Maggot can wait down here." I spotted Rick and a group of suited men and women, mostly Secret Service and feds. "I'll be eavesdropping over there." Oakham didn't acknowledge my comment. Without looking, he took a running start and bounded into Yummy's hand. The vampire tossed him up and forward, and he touched down on the roof with cat grace. In his cat form, that leap would have been easy all on his own. Yummy backed up and raced in, leaping onto the planter and pushing off with one foot. Oakham reached out over the edge and grabbed her arm, pulling her up. They collided, fell out of sight, and hit the roof. There was little doubt they had landed flat, together. Yummy laughed, sound delighted, teasing, sexual. A strange feeling opened up in my middle at her laughter. I was pretty sure I had never heard laughter like that before, but I knew what it was and what it meant. The strange feeling in my rooty middle went wide and empty at the sound, sad and betrayed, until Oakham said, "No," his tone cold and full of threat. "Look away from me." The vampire made a pouting sound. "You take all the fun out of the hunt. Now put away your toy before we have an incident."
"Put away your fangs first."
The frozen tone of his voice eased some of the odd emptiness inside me. If there had ever been something between them, it was long gone. I heard nothing else until the sounds of them rising reached me, and they walked across the metal roof. Then I heard them repeating what sounded like the hands and push, leap and catch being replayed as they attained the roof of the two-story building next over, one that shared a wall with a restaurant with no land in front. My attention returned to the shooting scene, and when I breathed, the air was heavy with diesel exhaust. All the emergency medical vehicle engines were still running. I turned and moved toward Rick. Through the law enforcement officers and crime scene techs, all milling around, all with jobs to do, I was almost to the street. Shots rang out. I dove to the pavers behind the planter. I caught a blur of movement from the corner of my eye on a roof. Either there were two shooters or the shooter had repositioned, catty-cornered across the street. He, or they, had us pinned down, but then the movement was gone. Had someone been targeted, or was the shooter just creating confusion so he, it, they could get away? My heart was slamming in my chest. My breath was fast and shallow. I was terrified. Had I mistaken clouds in the sky for a shooter? High up, I caught a distorted shape against the skyline, an amorphous form bending over a long rifle, aiming down. Three shots sounded. Three more. These three, hitting emergency vehicles with the injured inside. Chapter 4. Cops ran everywhere. Screams, shouting. "Jojo!" I shouted into my comms. "Active shooter on the roof of... I can't see the business name. Multi-story building on South Central. There's a white plaque in the brick, like an original name. It might start with a C and the word building after it."
"Hang on. I got your position."
I heard soft tapping. "You safe? You look like you're out in the open." I realized Jojo was following us in real time on the interactive map. "I'm behind a planter," I said, lifting my head. "But there's a cop in the street. She's 4 feet from me. She's hit. Bleeding. I'm gonna stay put," Jojo warned. "But stay put. That's an order." On the other side of the street, two paramedics and a cop rushed into an emergency medical van, bodies low, crouched. Even over the sound of the EMS engines, which were still running, I could hear the girl in the street panting. Blood trickled between the tiny rocks and the pavement. I could feel it, almost taste it. Bloodlust rose in me. Hesitant, uncertain, but interested. There was no land to feed here. Thank God, no land to feed. "Joe," I said, "she's..." The ambient noise on the comm system altered. "Attention, all law enforcement personnel," Jojo said. "The shooter has been spotted on the top of the Carhartt building." The EMS unit made a sharp turn at her words. More shots rang out, pinging into the vehicle, ramming right through the body of the oversized van and burying themselves in the street. The engine gunned and the van rolled into the street. In front of the downed officer, the engine block between the wounded woman and the shooter's position. The three responders fell out of the rear door to the asphalt, keeping low. They pulled emergency supplies from an oversized red kit, went to work on her. "Thanks, Joe," I said. I was panting hard.
"Not me. EMS did that all on their own. You got eyes on the shooter?"
Scraping along the brick pavers, I reversed my body position so I was facing the other way. The angle of the van's emergency lights now gave me more shadow protection, but if the shooter had low light or infrared vision goggles, I was toast. I pulled myself along the bricks on my elbows, in between two other concrete planters, and angled myself so I could see the top of the Carhartt building clearly, as fully as I could at night.
"Nothing," I said. "Except SWAT is converging there. If the shooter is still inside, he's caught."
"Is Oakham okay?" I asked.
"He's on the roof with a vampire," Jojo said.
"I know. RVAC has eyes in the air."
That was fast.
"City just had a multi-unit emergency response exercise. They got this one nailed." One of the paramedics in the street got back in the EMS unit, and it moved again, this time turning at a sharper angle to the Carhartt building. Yummy landed on all fours beside me like a praying mantis. I squelched a squeal and Yummy laughed. She was enjoying this. Without even thinking, I reached out, grabbed her shirt, and yanked her to me. Her face was 2 inches from mine, all vamped out, fangs down, eyes blood red with huge black pupils.
"That cop got injured," I said.
"Protecting this city and you're in boss. How about you and get in there and give her some blood instead of playing games?"
"Take your hand off me, little female."
"No." Yummy's eyes went even wider. Surprised. She tilted her head in one of those creepy inhuman moves they do and looked at the EMS unit. The driver was scrunched down in his seat, making a small target. The other two responders were loading the wounded officer into the back of the glorified ambulance. "Jojo," I said, "tell EMS that a vampire's about to join." I stretched my own head to see the numbers stenciled on the van. "Unit 214 to offer her services as blood donor." "Copy that," Jojo said. "I'll pick you up at UTMC," I said to the vampire. "I'll be thirsty," Yummy snarled. "I think the appropriate response is, prime me a river." I let go of Yummy's shirt. "Move." The vampire shot away from me with a pop of sound and landed at the back door of the EMS unit. And then she was inside the vehicle and the vehicle was backing down the street. I maybe should have felt bad about talking to Yummy that way. But short of staking a vamp, talking mean was about all that might get them to pay attention. "You scare me sometimes," Jojo said. "Oh? We saved a vamp's youngin' not so long ago. Call the Clayton vampire and get some more bloodsuckers to the hospital," I said. "Tell them they owe us." Oakham joined the conversation from somewhere, his voice calm and amused in my earbuds, and said, "Do it, but tell them they owe the city, not us. Tell them it'll be good PR. Jojo said, her tone saying she didn't like calling the vamps for favors of any kind. "Copy that," Rick said, "and ask nice." I jumped. I'd forgotten he was around tonight. "Yes, sir," Jojo said smartly, indicating she still didn't agree, but she could blame her supervisor if problems resulted from vampires feeding cops. Rick chuckled, the sound like dry leaves scattering before a slow wind. Oakham appeared between the planters, near my feet. He hadn't jumped from above, so he must have come down from the roof elsewhere and cat-crawled to me. "Did I hear you just threaten a bloodsucker, Nell Sugar?" "Special Agent Ingram," I said, tapping my earpiece with a fingernail, reminding him we were being recorded and every word could be transcribed. "Right." Oakham gave me a cat grin, all self-satisfaction. "Wish I'd seen that, Nell Sugar." "We got two RVACs in the air now," Jojo said, "and local LEOs just obtained footage from traffic cams showing an armed figure fleeing the scene, heading south on South Gay Street. Obtaining the images now. Stay in position. SWAT is clearing the Carhartt building." Oakham said, "The Mithrin and I cleared the roof and building at hour 9. I'll let the local LEOs know." In the wake of the EMS unit pulling away, two others backed out, each carrying injured. Oakham cat crawled higher into the tight space, close enough for me to feel his wear warmth as he lay on the pavers beside me. Close enough for me to be uncomfortable, though he never indicated he was aware of anything untoward and lying on the ground so close to me. It was odd, and oddly comforting to have a fellow agent in the cramped space with me. Fellow agent, that was what I thought of him. A small part of me questioned whether it was just any agent or Oakham himself that created the comfort. Oakham and I had unfinished business between us. Or I thought we did. He had asked me out for a date, nearly a month ago, for a dinner that had never happened. The memory of that invitation surfaced, and I blushed for no reason I could fathom. I had thought about that invitation off and on, and figured he had changed his mind since he never mentioned it again. I couldn't decide if I was relieved or insulted or disappointed, but since I didn't date, not ever, I had settled on relieved. But I still thought about it, mostly at night before I fell asleep. Thinking about it now made me break out in a hot sweat and made me suddenly cranky. I wondered if the werecat could smell my change in physical state, and that made me more cranky. However, I didn't want to look at those questions, not in the middle of a shootout, and so I shoved my feelings away and turned my attention back to the actions along the street. We waited, not sure if it was safe to move yet. Not talking, just sharing the narrow gap, holding position.
Okay, got the images from the traffic cams, JoJo said. Looks like either the same shooter from last night or a similar creature. Fuzzed features, male gait. Seems to be carrying an M4 carbine, just like last night. Looks like we have a single shooter, at events where the senator, his rich brother, and their wives are.
Where's the shooter now? Rick asked.
They don't know. He took a turn through an alley and vanished. The alley has access to buildings on either side, to their roofs, to a parking lot, and to three streets front and back. 2 minutes after he vanished, a black SUV pulled into traffic, then a Mercedes and a beat-up truck like Nell's. Two motorcycles, probably Yamahas, sped past traffic cams, and a bicycle. They're clearing the buildings and the parking lot, but my personal opinion is, they lost him.
The next hour ticked by slowly, sharing the space behind the planter with Oakham while the SWAT officers in tactical gear and the uniformed officers cleared every single building up and down the street. It was almost pleasant, even though the brick was cold and I was freezing, and I was thirsty, and I had to go to the bathroom. And Oakham was lying so close. Not that he did anything untoward or unpleasant, but I had never been so close to a man for so long, not even when I was married. Marital relations between John and me had been fast and mostly unpleasant, and most nights I had then slept elsewhere.
I wish we had coffee,
he muttered after an unconscionable amount of time. And some of that cold pizza on the all shelf of the refrigerator in the break room, I fantasized.
Who brought Elidio's pizza in? It's all the way out on Callahan and Central Avenue Pike.
I guess Rick. He doesn't sleep much, I added, except on the new moon. Oakham swiveled his head to watch me in the darkness.
And you know that how, Nell Sugar.
I shrugged. It was part of the claiming healing. I just knew things about Rick sometimes, and when there was no moon, he slept hard and deep. Oakham let it slide.
You never ate at Elidio's Pizza?
When I shook my head, no, he said. The unit should go there for supper one night. I made a noncommittal sound, and Oakham turned his attention back to the streets, and the wait that was both boring and too full of turmoil. When the city police had determined that the immediate area was safe enough to move, I crawled to my feet, left Oakham lying there, and entered the closest restaurant, begging to use of the bathroom and something to eat, anything they had left over. The restaurant manager, two cooks, and three wait persons had been hiding in the kitchen, and they opened the place up just for the emergency responders, offering sandwiches and reheated soup, food that they claimed would be thrown out anyway. It was pretty good eating, according to the officers who came in for something warm. But to a girl raised in the church, where women knew how to cook, the bread was slightly stale and the soup needed bay, thyme, and black pepper. I didn't say that, though. I knew about gift horses and minding my manners, and I was hungry enough to eat that gift horse. Once I had used the facilities and stuffed soup and a sandwich in my mouth, and Oakham had eaten three hoagies with double meat, we went our separate ways. Oakham to take Rick some food and work with him on perimeter and rooftop examination, as well as the pattern of physical evidence. Crime scene tech showed up and began the collating and collection process. I traced up and down the street with the psi meter 2.0, catching small spikes on level 4 again. So the readings hadn't been erroneous. Our shooter creature, whatever he was, had a definite pattern. It suddenly hit me. I read a low level 4, but I didn't spike. So this thing wasn't a whatever I was. Relief and maybe a little regret moved through me like a slow tide. I sent my new info to JoJo at headquarters and then crossed the street and entered the relatively warm room the city police had commandeered for questioning witnesses, where two FBI agents, T. Lane and Tandy, interviewed the bystanders and the people who had been in the restaurant. I watched through the door until the questioning was over, and the last haggard couple left the room for the cold of night, followed by the Psi-Led agents. They stopped when they saw me. T-Lane said,
"No one saw anything except the chaos that erupted when the shooting started. Questioning so far has been an exercise in futility."
T-Lane had perfect teeth and had lots of schooling. Most notably, she had some training in large animal veterinary medicine, which came in handy with Unit 18's werecats. I looked at Tandy for his assessment. He looked pale, and there were dark circles under his eyes. His reddish hair was mussed up, as if he'd been running his hands through it.
"No nudges on his truthometer," T-Lane said, "but he's tired, and we have the bigwigs to talk to next." "Too much fear in such a small place," he said. "Panic has a smell and a taste, and..."
His words cut off as he swallowed.
"Go take a break,"
T-Lane said.
"Get hydrated. Nell can help me with this one."
A tingle of excitement raced through me, but I squished it down. "There's water, coffee, and food across the street. The manager stayed on after he officially closed up, just for law enforcement."
"Yeah, thanks."
Tandy walked away. "Bigwigs?" I asked.
"The Tollivers, the senator and Justin, the rich brother, and their wives."
She sent me a knowing look, her dark eyes amused.
"Excited, Proby?
As a dog with his tail stuck in an electric fence." T-Lane shook her head and said to me, "Come on, grab a water. No telling how this will go. We'll have Secret Service and Thieves and God knows who else in there with us." The room was short on space, short on heat, and short on amenities. It had a 5-foot-long folding table with a lamp on it and a few chairs, 2 for the couple, 1 for the questioner, and 3 against the wall out of the way, so the interviewed would see only the primary interrogator. The rest of us were supposed to stand. The air inside was stale, laced with the stink of the fire and scorched coffee. There was also a plastic-wrapped case of water and a stack of legal pads, as well as the recording equipment, which consisted of a futuristic mic, a 4-inch freestanding handle topped with a metal circle and a wire through it, hardwired to a box about the size of a pack of playing cards. T-Lane had her sellout to record. So did the others. I didn't bother. An African-American woman in a trench coat, pants, and low heels walked into the room, and I had no doubt this was the Secret Service special agent in charge of the crime scene. Behind her, and similarly dressed, strode another woman, one I recognized from the Holloway's house investigation. Stevens? Schultz? They both placed tablets and pads for notes on the table and looked around at us, taking everyone in. The second woman's eyes didn't so much meet mine as bore a hole into my brain. I had made a reputation for myself when I took down the Knoxville FBI chief as a paranormal serial killer, and some feds didn't like me much. The first woman spoke. "For those who haven't met us, I am Special Agent Elizabeth Crowley, Secret Service. This is Special Agent E.M. Schultz, FBI. I will be leading this discussion, not interrogation, discussion. The Tollivers are neither persons of interest, nor are they suspects. They are an elected government official and his wife, and they are distraught. They are terrified. This will not be questioning as usual. If you have a question, you may ask it after Schultz and I have completed our questions. You will be polite and respectful and show proper deference. Is that clear?" I nodded. T-Lane nodded. Everyone nodded. I had a feeling that anyone who disagreed would have been put out of the room with extreme prejudice. The SSSAIC was scary. She picked up the mic, clicked it on, gave the date and time, and introduced herself. "This is Elizabeth Crowley, Secret Service. I am joined by..." She held the mic to Schultz, who gave her name and rank. Crowley then pointed the mic at T-Lane, who said, "Psi-Led Special Agent Tammy Lane Kent." Crowley went around the room and ended with a finger pointed at me. "Psi-Led Probationary Special Agent Nell Nicholson Ingram." Crowley looked back and forth between T-Lane and me,
as if memorizing our faces and putting them together with a mental dossier she was keeping on each of us.
Anything I should know from your agency before we began?
T-Lane shook her head, no. I raised a hand the way I had in grade school. Ming of Glass seems to be afraid that both attacks were actually aimed at her.
The master of the city of Knoxville? Crowley asked.
T-Lane's fingers jerked out in some kind of warning, but I couldn't interpret the gesture.
No, ma'am. Ming of Glass is blood master of Clan Glass, but there is no MOC. Knoxville falls under the territory of Leo Pelissier of New Orleans.
I could see things taking place behind Crowley's eyes, but I couldn't interpret them either.
I see. And Ming of Glass. She was here?
Yes, ma'am.
And you let her leave?
Oh, dear.
Now I could interpret T-Lane's finger wave. It was a keep-your-mouth-shut signal.
We'll talk after.
She pointed at the suit closest to the door.
Bring them in.
They brought Senator Tolliver and his wife in, and I focused all my senses and abilities on them. The senator looked younger than his age, his face taut and firm, with minimal wrinkles at the corners of his eyes and around his mouth. A self-important, condescending man hiding behind a facade that was usually friendly, interested. But that facade was cracked now, and arrogance was peeking through, making his eyes hard and dark. His nose was slightly hooked, nostrils a little too thin to be called handsome. The senator's wife, Clarice, was younger than he, her face pale, her mascara smudged, as if she had been crying. She wore her hair in a dark, short bob streaked blonde, and had blue eyes. She held on to the senator's hand under the table, and he leaned to her, saying quietly, "It's almost over. We'll be home soon." She touched her mouth, an indication of nerves, and said,
"I'm just worried about Devin."
"The Secret Service are with him. He's in good hands."
Her husband smiled. "He's probably asleep. And if not, then he's beating the pants off them at some video game." Clarice laughed shakily and touched his shoulder. She seemed like a China doll woman, easily breakable. Or maybe already broken and glued back together so the porcelain face was what the public usually saw, and not the hurting, fractured woman beneath.
"You can do this," he whispered.
Her face changed. She gave a practiced smile to her husband, and then to Crowley, the perfect doll face mask back in place. The senator studied her a moment, then nodded to proceed.
"Thank you for helping us with the timeline," Crowley said. "It's very important to the investigation, and I appreciate the care and effort it must take after two such violent and horrifying situations."
"I've never been in a firefight before," Clarice said. "It happened so fast."
"What time did you arrive at the restaurant?" Crowley asked.
I listened with half an ear and turned my attention to other things, like the hallway just beyond us, where a stretcher, covered by a white sheet over a formless shape, was rolled past. I was glad Clarice wasn't looking.
"Who was your waiter?" Crowley asked.
"I don't remember," Clarice said. "Do you, dear?"
"Mark? Luke? I remember it was one of the Gospels. I'm usually better at names,"
Abram said, sounding self-deprecating, as if to indicate his bravery and confusion.
"Where were you seated?"
Schultz asked.
"Could you see out into the street?"
"No, we were seated side by side facing the kitchen," Abram said. "The chef is supposed to be quite amazing. We had just placed our order, and we're talking small talk and business."
"The waiter was bringing our soup. He had just stepped from the kitchen. The tray full of soup bowls exploded,"
Clarice said, her eyes growing wider, her fingers touching her mouth again.
"Then the man across from me jerked."
Her fingers pressed hard against her lips, and she spoke through them.
"He was just getting ready to stand, leaning forward and up. His head went bloody and blood splattered all over the woman behind him. People started screaming. I started screaming.
Her eyes filled with tears, and I realized that she was wearing colored contacts, the eyes beneath them gray and not the pretty blue she showed to the world. I remembered the contacts on the corpse's eyes at the Holloway's house. Was there a connection? With contact lenses? No, that was foolish. Clarice wiped her eyes, smearing the mascara even more.
Can we please go?
I think we're done here. I need to get my wife home, Abrams said, standing, giving a politician's smile, one that said several things at once. The most obvious was that he was too important to deal with the kind of questioning suffered by the hoi polloi, and that he had been far more patient than he had to be. I can come in tomorrow and give a statement. My wife will be writing hers and sending it in by email. I have your card. If there are problems with that arrangement, you can certainly speak with my attorney.
Of course, Senator. Thank you for staying and talking to us. If we have further questions, we'll be in touch. But I can't imagine that'll be necessary, Crowley said smoothly. Stephen, see them safely to their Secret Service escorts and then to their car, please. Make sure they get away safely. And see Justin Tolliver and his wife in.
Yes, ma'am,
a suit said and opened the door.
This way, Senator, Mrs. Tolliver.
My brother and his wife had to leave, Abrams Tolliver said. Babysitter complications. He said to call and he'd come to you at your convenience. Abrams held out a hand to Crowley. Our cards with office and private contact information.
Thank you, Crowley said. Though it was clear she was peeved that someone had left her interrogation site.
When they were gone, Crowley turned off the mic and looked around the room.
Comments?
One, I said. He had a crust of mud on his shoe.
It was a dress shoe. Fancy. He was in the city.
Why mud?
Anything particularly odd about the mud? She asked, as if humoring me.
Not a thing, I said. If he was a farmer, he'd been in a car in a restaurant, not a field.
Nell, T-Lane said.
What, you think she's going to bite me?
Speaking of biting, why did you let Ming of Glass go? Crowley asked smoothly.
It was a cop question, slid in when not expected, hoping to get a reaction.
Because she wasn't in the restaurant when the firing started. She drove up later. She waited around for a while in case you needed to talk to her, but then she left. I've got her number if you need to talk to her.
I held up my cell. You have the master of the...
She stopped.
You have the number of Ming of Glass in your personal cell phone database?
Her security guard, actually.
Whose name I didn't know. Calling her Yummy would be embarrassing, but the SSSAIC didn't ask for it.
I wouldn't call in the daytime. That's like poking a sleeping lion with a stick.
I'll keep it in mind.
Crowley stood and gathered her belongings, her face expressionless, her emotions indecipherable.
Include that information in your report, she said to me.
To the others, she said, you are all dismissed. I expect reports in my email by 10 a.m.
We all filed out of the room and into the cleanup. There were three wounded and one dead, not counting the officer. Lots of rounds fired, and no one had seen anything. I scanned the files being put together by JoJo and recognized none of the victims' names. Worse, with the exception of the presence of the senator and the expected presence of Ming of Glass, Joe could find nothing that tied any of the dead or wounded to each other or to the people at the Holloway's party. The worry about assassination or domestic or paranormal terrorism was still a very real possibility.
Near dawn, JoJo said into my earpiece, Nell, I got a vamp calling, saying she needs her taxi driver at University of Tennessee Medical Center. She asked for Maggot.
Ha ha, I said, but I slid off my chair and jogged my truck. I gave her my ETA and once again appreciated the superheater in the old Chevy. Yummy opened the passenger door, looked over the interior, and said, "You have got to be kidding."
"Nope. You could call an Uber."
Her face scrunched in distaste. She slid in and closed the door. "Hell, Maggot. Can't you afford a new car? Doesn't Silad provide you a car? Does it have a radio?" She punched the buttons and twisted the knobs. "Probably, eventually, and yes. But it stopped working last week. Buckle up." I slid her a sideways glance and pulled into the light 5 a.m. traffic as she complied. "No working radio. We'll have to talk," I said. "About maggots?" I laughed. "About life. Tell me about yourself. I'm sure you have a dossier on me. Read it." "My time's valuable." I let my words glide into church speak. "Ewins ain't important enough to me to read it." Yummy burst out laughing and twisted around in the seat so her legs were splayed, one knee angled at me. "I like you, Nell."
"Hmm. You're not going to say you like me?"
"My mama taught me to be polite and to not lie. Those two things aren't always mutually agreeable." Yummy laughed again and dropped her head against the back window with a soft thud. Her very pale blonde hair swung and fell still. "I was born the first time in 1932 in a little town in South Louisiana. I was turned in 1953 by a vamp named Gregoire, who said he loved me and that we should be together forever. He looked 15, but in the sack he was truly immortal." Yummy glanced my way. He could do things with his mouth. Yummy was testing the waters, seeing how far she could go. I had learned quickly that no reaction was the best reaction when dealing with paranormal creatures, especially the predatory kind. I didn't react, just eased through a green light and up behind an early school bus. Yummy went on. "Sadly, when I woke up dead in 1960, early by Mithrin standards, Gregoire had moved on, emotionally and sexually, and was sleeping with young men and the master of the city of New Orleans, Leo Pelissier, a former and, once again, lover. In the intervening years, my brothers went to war and never came back. My father died of a heart attack working in a paper mill, and Mama remarried and moved away." Yummy's accent had changed as she spoke, taking on a twang I didn't really recognize. Maybe Frenchy Southern, an accent that was biscuits and gravy with hot sauce and alligator sausage or something. It was slightly like Rick's when he was tired or angry, but softer, more melodious. She went on, now sounding a little sad, and I had to wonder if she knew she was giving so much away, or if she just needed to talk and didn't care what she exposed about herself. Instead of being head over heels in love, I was part of the Clan Arsenault blood family. But I was alone, a bloodsucker of little consequence, living with fangheads I didn't much like and what amounted to human slaves. I was a small fish in a large fishbowl full of predators, all with bigger teeth than I had. She looked my way again, and I pretended to be wholly focused on the street and the lights ahead. I wasn't interested in group sex, in making new slaves, or in helping to run a vamp's household. So I learned to fight and went to war, as much as women were allowed to in Uncle Sam's army back then. When I got back, I took on all comers until I killed one of Gregoire's favorites and he sent me to Ming of Glass. I've been here ever since. That was a lot more than I expected her to tell me. I made a soft noise as I digested her story. "Your turn, Maggot." I grinned at the windshield and quoted her. "I'm sure you have a dossier on me. Read it." When she stopped chuckling, Yummy said, "I like you more and more, Nell Nicholson Ingram. Okay, how's this? You were raised in God's Cloud of Glory Church, became a common law wife to John Ingram at age 12 and nursed his wife Leah until she died. Then you married him legally and nursed him until he died. You inherited all his land, which shared a boundary with the church, against which you led a war of ignoring and attrition for years.
During that time, you educated yourself at the local library and recently got a GED. You joined Sci-Lead this year. You graduated in the middle third of your class at Sci-Lead Training School and would have graduated higher had you received a traditional education. As it was, you classified as an expert marksman with two weapons. When you finally took the weapons qualification course, top of your class in poli-sci, and bottom of your class in interpersonal interactions.
Not bad, I said. Every special agent had to qualify for weapons and re-qualify at regular intervals. It wasn't as rigorous as the military's qualification, but it was thorough and I hadn't been certain where I had positioned in the class or what my final ranking would be. My certificates had come in the mail less than a week ago, and I was proud of them. That Yummy knew all about that meant the vampires were capable of doing or buying deep background research on federal agents. That was something I'd have to think about later. I'm not good at flirting or making small talk, but I bake good bread, make excellent soup, and have even better survival skills.
Now that we're done showing off, Yummy said, and since you aren't about to let me feed on your soft, beautiful neck, how about pulling over and let's get breakfast?
She pointed to an IHOP.
I'm paying.
Deal, I said, swinging the wheel and popping into the parking spot. It's nearly dawn, and it's your skin that'll be burned crispy, but I'm hungry enough to risk you dying again.
Aren't you just the sweetest little thing?
I grinned at her as I slid from the warmth into the cold and slammed the door. I may not have fangs, but I can still bite. Yummy on my heels, I thought that my mama would have a conniption fit if I was ever dumb enough to tell her that I'd had breakfast with a fang head, especially since I wasn't hungry. But making friends with a paranormal creature who could fight might be smart. If friendship was actually happening here, I wasn't yet sure. It was after dawn when I used the inconspicuous keypad to enter the unmarked door between Yoshi's Deli and Coffee's On and into the field office of Sci-Lead Unit 18. As I entered, I gave a half-hearted wave at the very conspicuous roving surveillance camera over the door and waited until it closed behind me before I slogged up the stairs into the Sci-Lead offices. I was so exhausted my knees wanted a buckle. I dropped my gear on the desk in my cubicle and stuck my fingers into the soil of the plants lining the window. A feeling of completeness rushed over me, feeling much like waves rolling over a beach. Not that I had ever seen such a thing in person. I'd been close to the ocean when I went to spook school, but it wasn't some place I wanted to go alone. The videos I had seen of the Atlantic made me think of isolation and aloneness and abandonment. The soil and the mulch and the compost in my plants had the power of the ocean, but without the loneliness and isolation. They were all from Soulwood and connected me to my land instantly. The soil felt a little too dry, and I made a mental note to water the plants. As I withdrew my fingers, I brushed them over the herbs and the mixed scents of three kinds of basil, lemony thyme, and oniony chives filled my nostrils. I locked away my gun and found the coffee machine with my eyes closed. I pretty much slept through writing my report and the debriefing that followed, and later I could never have explained how I drove all the way to my house and crawled into my bed. I woke when one cat leaped to my outside bedroom windowsill, yowling that it was time to come back inside. I stumbled out of bed, let the cats in, and fed the mousers dry kibble. Still half asleep, I added scrap paper to coax the coals alive in the skin-temp firebox of the Waterford Stanley wood-burning cook stove. Living off the grid was time-consuming, never-ending hard work. Fortunately, thanks to muscle memory and repetition, I could do most of it in my sleep. When I had some flames, I added kindling, hot-burning cedar, and slow-burning oak to the firebox and adjusted the dampers, topped up the water heater on the back of the stove, testing the warmth with my hand. It was still warm, but not hot. I fumbled around and made a whole pot of coffee in the bun and scrambled some eggs, while bread toasted and water heated. I did not want a tepid shower. I ate standing in front of the stove, my wool socks doing nothing to keep my feet warm, The house was frigid, another one of the drawbacks of living mostly off the grid. I had been thinking about buying a small electric space heater, but the watt-hours usage might not be worth the speed of the warmth. The stove would eventually heat the house to bearable without depleting the solar panels. At least that was what I told myself today.